We have two papers dealing with social, economic, and legal, political aspects of the Reformation, as illustrated by case studies pertaining to the life of imperial cities, Frankfurt, Weissenburg in Bavaria, and Schweinfurt. We will proceed as follows. We'll first have the paper by Mr. Buck on rent charges and reform revolt in the city of Frankfurt, and then the paper by Mr. Bepp on paving the way for the Reformation in Weissenburg and Schweinfurt. I was asked before, do you want to know something about us? And I said, quite frankly, no. I suppose we all know Larry, and well, so there's really not much to be said, except perhaps to say that both papers were really not, quote, written or made for this session, but both papers are the byproduct of some larger work. Larry is working on a kind of comparative study of the year 1525 in the life of some of the imperial cities, and Phil is working on what ought to turn out to be the major biography of Christoph Scheuerl, the Nuremberg jurist, and his paper is a offshoot of that work. Okay, then, our first paper by Larry Buck on rent charges, reform, and revolt in Frankfurt.
At the suggestion of some of the people that I've spoken with during the past couple of days, I want to make a few introductory remarks. One person suggested to me that I give it a different title, and the second title that I've come up with, the title that was that I came up with after completing the paper, was Purgatory and Urban Blight, because that's really what I'm talking about, is the interconnection between the theology of purgatory and the problem of urban blight in the city of Frankfurt. And I really divide the paper into three sections, one section dealing with the affairs and the activities of the city council with regard to these two topics. The second section deals with the early evangelical reformers in Frankfurt, and the third with urban rebels in Frankfurt, insofar as they were concerned with those two topics. The second suggestion which I want to act on is to try to explain ahead of time what a rent charge is before I get into some rather dense language about rent charges. Rent charge is an archaic financial instrument that was used in the late medieval and early modern period, and it works like this. Someone who's wealthy and who has the money to invest, and we can call Mr. A the rent charger, gives a lump sum of money to a purchaser or debtor, who I will refer to as Mr. B. He gets this money with which he can then invest in his own enterprise, or whatever it might be, and in return he encumbers either himself or his property with ongoing regular payments. They can be for a term of years or in perpetuity. So this is the rent charger, this is the purchaser or debtor. One of the most widespread grievances in the German urban insurrections of 1525 concerned rents and rent charges. Dissidents aired complaints on this topic at Cologne, Münster, Osnabrück, Nördlingen, Mainz, Würzburg, Nuremberg, Langenwalter, Bopart, Limburg, and Frankfurt on Main. The universality of the problem of rent charges is sufficient justification for an inquiry into this topic. The fact that the standard surveys of the Peasants' War and the urban revolts either ignore the issue of rent charges or pass over it in vague, misleading terms makes a systematic study all the more needed. To my knowledge, Frankfurt offers the best case for such a study because the baneful effects of rent charges were particularly severe there. Also, in Frankfurt, several different groups, city council, early evangelical reformers, and urban dissidents, attempted to deal with the problem. My conclusions are limited to Frankfurt, but I hope they will suggest approaches for research in other cities as well. The generic term rents refers to a wide variety of payments, including ground rents, life rents or annuities, and rent charges, which could be either terminal or perpetual, primary or secondary. Ground rents paid to the owner of land which was let for building upon, and life rents, annuities paid in return for an investment of capital with interest, are still in use today. 16th century ground rents and life rents were similar enough to their modern counterparts as to require little clarification. A rent charge, however, is a more archaic financial instrument which needs some explanation. The sale of rent charges developed in the Middle Ages as a means of providing relatively large sums of money in an economy that frequently suffered from cash shortages. A property owner or the holder of an hereditary tenancy, B, would purchase a rent charge from some wealthy person, A. B received a sum of money from A in return for encumbering his property with the obligation of paying rents either for a term of years, a terminal charge, or in perpetuity. Terminal rent charges were more common in the countryside. Perpetual rents were more typical of cities. The one obligated to pay rents, B, was referred to as the purchaser or debtor. The one who received the rents was the rent charger, A. Rent charges were clearly advantageous to both parties. The purchaser, who might be a merchant in need of capital for his trade, could thus acquire such capital. The rent charger could guarantee for himself and his heirs an ongoing income. Legally, rent charges were real property which could be taxed or sold or bequeathed by the rent charger to a third party. Thus, the heirs of the original debtor frequently had to pay rents for monies that they had never seen to persons who had no part in the original agreement. They inherited a perennial liability. A given property or tenancy could be encumbered with more than one rent charge, that is, with secondary rent charges. In fact, in the later Middle Ages, it frequently happened that the number of rent charges against a piece of property amounted to more money than the property was worth. In this circumstance, the debtor, or his heirs, might simply abandon the property and, in the case of Frankfurt, move to the Faubourg Neustadt to build a new house. There was thus a constant threat of urban decay. For example, in Frankfurt, the number of abandoned and burned-out properties increased from 165 in 1420 to 403 in 1463. In 1541, Emperor Charles V himself referred to the bad effects of rent charges, noting decayed and deserted houses that gave, quote, an ugly appearance to entire streets of Frankfurt, close quote. This urban blight was in part a consequence of the deliberate investment policies of the ecclesiastical establishment of Frankfurt. The monasteries and collegiate churches saw rent charges as a safe field of investment through which they could obtain a steady income without assuming the obligation of managing additional properties. On the other hand, the ecclesiastical establishment was unavoidably driven to become a collector of rents by the very operation of the intercessory apparatus of the church. Pious men gave rents as endowments for chantries, annuals, obits, lights, and the like. For example, in 1522, a wealthy merchant, Jakob Heller, left 400 gulden to the Dominican cloister for the purchase of rents to pay for daily requiem masses, special anniversary masses, and a perpetual light. Rents in support of intercessory institutions were certainly not peculiar to Frankfurt. But there were many more clerical rents in Frankfurt than in other cities. 16th century inventories of ecclesiastical rent charges show thousands of rents owed to the collegiate and monastic churches. The growth of the number of ecclesiastical rent charges threatened the city's financial stability, for since 1299, clerical properties in Frankfurt had enjoyed tax-exempt status. Approximately one-third of all real estate in the city was held in mortmain, and the ever-expanding number of clerical rent charges not only burdened the citizenry and contributed to urban blight, it also deprived the city of part of its tax base. The city council was fully cognizant of the problem posed by ecclesiastical rent charges and had worked throughout the later Middle Ages to resolve the issue. It ultimately failed to do so because of the recalcitrance of Frankfurt's own clergy. As early as 1376, Emperor Charles IV ordered that lands or rent charges used as endowments for intercessory institutions be sold to laymen within 1 year, and that any new grants likewise be secularized within a year of receipt. In 1407, the council negotiated an agreement with the Archbishop of Mainz that restated Charles IV's order, but with a new cutoff date. Ecclesiastical rents acquired after 1407 had to be secularized within a year. This part of the agreement, however, was not enforced, and the expansion of Mortmain properties continued apace. The period from 1420 to 1463 saw a 144% increase in the number of abandoned properties in Frankfurt. Convinced that clerical rents were to blame, the council issued a stern decree in 1439 prohibiting future sales of perpetual rents. Henceforth, only extinguishable rents could be laid on properties in the city, that is, those that could be bought off. To enforce this decree, the council ordered that all new rent charges had to be sealed in the city chancellery in the presence of the burgomaster and another council member. The clergy, however, circumvented the council's order by sealing new rents with the seals of their collegiate churches. Thus, they foiled another attempt at reform. The problems created by rent charges continued to worsen through the 15th century. In 1470, Emperor Frederick III renewed Charles IV's order of 1376. In 1477, even Pope Sixtus IV issued a bull affirming the imperial order. The council, however, found all of these orders unenforceable. In the 16th century, the government took a slightly different approach. Rather than prohibiting the sale of perpetual rents, it attempted to make all clerical rents redeemable. At a meeting with other cities in Esslingen in 1522, Frankfurt's delegates unsuccessfully tried to arrange for a cooperative urban policy on rents at the upcoming imperial diet at Nuremberg. In 1523, in response to popular protests at the Frankfurt village of Bornheim, the council tried to make all rents, both clerical and secular, redeemable. The year 1524 saw the development of a vociferous evangelical movement in Frankfurt and in its hinterland. Protesters demanding a reform preacher in the village of Sachsenhausen provided the council with the opportunity of opening discussions with officials at Mainz on a variety of topics, including rent charges. The archbishopal officials, however, rejected Frankfurt's suggestions for reform, leaving the city fathers in a weak position for facing the unrest of 1525. The city council was not alone in its opposition to rent charges, for the early evangelical reformers in Frankfurt also treated this topic. At times, they attacked the institution of rent charges directly. At other times, they aimed their attacks at the theology that justified the intercessory institutions, which many of the rents supported. To appreciate the interconnection between rent charges and the Frankfurt evangelical movement, it is necessary briefly to consider the theology that supported the endowed chantries. Two theological tenets were chiefly responsible for the establishment of intercessory institutions: the Catholic doctrine of the Mass and the teaching on purgatory. According to the latter, the souls of those who died penitent were made fit for paradise by expiation of venial sins through punishment in purgatory. According to the former, the Mass was seen as a reenactment of Christ's original sacrifice, which could accrue merit for the souls of the departed suffering in purgatory. As a consequence of these teachings, it became customary for those who could afford to do so to endow chantries where stipendiary priests could say services in the name of the departed to shorten his stay in purgatory. The clergy who performed these services were known as stipendiary priests, mass priests, chantrists, intercessory priests, or purgatory priests. It was a peculiarity of the Frankfurt Reformation that the evangelical movement in its early stages dwelt more on purgatory and rents than it did on more typically Lutheran topics like justification by faith or the universal priesthood of believers. The man who preached the first evangelical sermon in Frankfurt was Hartmann Ebach, a native of Marburg and a former Franciscan monk. The reform-minded patrician trustees of St. Catherine's Nunnery brought Ebach to Frankfurt to preach a series of Lenten sermons at the Cloister Church in 1522. On March 11th, he spoke against perpetual rents, urging his listeners not to pay their rents, but rather to use this money for poor relief. Ebach's attack did not go unnoticed by the Frankfurt clergy. The arch-conservative parish preacher, Dr. Peter Meyer, personally attended Ebach's sermon on rents and was so disturbed that he went to Mainz to urge archiepiscopal officials to take action against him. The council, fearing that the Lenten sermons might cause some sort of civil disturbance, entreated Ebach to leave Frankfurt. He departed in 1522. Sometime around mid-year 1523, the secular administrators of St. Catherine's arranged for another advocate of reform, Dietrich Pastorius, to come to Frankfurt. Formerly a cleric at the parish of St. Ignatius at Mainz, Sartorius came to Frankfurt as a preacher at St. Catherine's. From his chancel there, he attacked the doctrine of the Mass as a sacrifice and the traditional teaching on purgatory, both of which were essential for the meaningful operation of endowed intercessory institutions. Officials at Mainz complained about Sartorius's sermons, but he withstood archiepiscopal opposition much longer than Ebach. He preached regularly at St. Catherine's from about mid-year 1523 until November 1524. During this year and a half, he exercised considerable influence upon the populace of the city. The citizenry soon began to organize its own protests against the doctrine of purgatory and against perpetual rent charges. Sartorius's ministry had led to the founding of groups calling themselves Evangelical Brothers, or Lovers of the Word of God and Christian Truth, in Frankfurt, in Sachsenhausen, and at Oberursel. The Evangelical Brothers came to the council's attention after they became embroiled in a dispute with the Dominicans over the doctrine of purgatory. On November 6, 1524, three of the Evangelical Brothers of Frankfurt had a verbal exchange with the Dominican lector over a sermon he had preached on All Souls' Day. Later, these same men presented the Black Friars with five articles that they had drafted to provide scriptural proof for the rejection of the doctrine of purgatory. The altercation was serious enough to prompt the Dominicans to ask the council for protection against these men. The leader of the Evangelical Brothers in this dispute was the shoemaker Hans von Siegen. He was also the most important leader of the popular rebellion in 1525. At that time, one of his most adamantine demands concerned the extinguishment of perpetual rent charges and the conversion of the revenues for intercessory institutions into monies for the common chest. So this one man then is active both in the movement against purgatory in 1524 and against rent charges in 1525. The Evangelical Brothers remained organized and active through the winter and spring of 1524-25. November 24, 1524, they submitted a petition to the city council asking that Sartorius be allowed to continue his ministry in Frankfurt. The council had forced him to stop his preaching in November. In April 1525, just before open revolt broke out in the city, they submitted to the council 11 articles in which were articulated ecclesiastical, political, and economic grievances. These articles were eventually incorporated into the much larger 46 articles of the Frankfurt Insurgents. Of particular interest for this study are points 3 and 10 of the 11 articles, which call for perpetual rents to be made extinguishable and for undocumented rents to be declared null and void. The actions of the Evangelical Brothers clearly demonstrate the interconnection of concerns about purgatory, intercessory institutions, and perpetual rent charges. In late fall or winter of 1524, the Evangelical Brothers were joined by Gerhard Westerburg, a native of Cologne and a doctor of Roman and canon law, who had become a dedicated follower of Andreas Karlstein. City Chancellor Johann Marsteller recorded in his so-called Aufruhrbuch that Westerburg's home became the meeting place of the Evangelical Brothers, and that Westerburg consulted with Hans von Siegen and his cohorts by day and by night, but especially at night. Westerburg's influence was of special significance, for he is best known for his opposition to the doctrine of purgatory. In fact, his only known publication up to this time was a work entitled Vom Fegefeuer und Stand der verschiedenen Seelen. Westerburg did not found the Evangelical Brothers, as has sometimes been argued, for he did not even come to Frankfurt until after they had already had their altercation with the Dominicans. However, he himself need not have been in Frankfurt to influence the Evangelical Brothers, for when he published his anti-purgatorial treatise in 1523, he sent the available copies to Cologne, to the Netherlands, and to Frankfurt. Thus, it is quite possible that the evangelical brothers had read his work before he arrived in their midst. In any case, we know that he joined the evangelical brothers after November 1524. His presence thus helps to explain popular attitudes toward the doctrine of purgatory, intercessory institutions, and the endowed rents that supported them. Festerberg's influence extended well into the famous urban revolt of 1525. In fact, in an attempt to end the revolt, the council expelled him from the city. The events of 1525 clearly demonstrated the importance of the topic of perpetual rents in the minds of the Frankfurt populace. The insurrection broke out on April 17, 1525, during the high point of the Peasants' War. About noon on Easter Monday, dissidents from the Faubourgs of Sachsenhausen and Neustadt assembled in the St. Peter's Churchyard in Neustadt to protest perpetual rents and excise taxes. Although Hans von Siegen was not one of the original organizers of this protest, he quickly emerged as the most important leader of the dissidents. That day, the protesters attacked the Dominican monastery and the nearby Fronhof, where St. Bartholomew's chapter stored the rents it collected in kind. The council's immediate response to the protesters on April the 18th was to order the collegiate churches and the monasteries to make complete inventories of their rents and other incomes, quote, damit der Gemeindemann gestillt werde, close quote. This was not enough, though, for the street demonstrations continued. On April 18th, the rebels armed themselves and occupied the city gates. April 19th, they elected a 61-member committee to negotiate with the city council. The committee of 61 drafted a statement of grievances, which it presented to the council on April the 20th. But before the concessions could be sealed and formally adopted, Hans von Siegen and his cohorts added three more points of their own, that is, Articles 43, 44, and 45. With the concluding statement, the council thus agreed to 46 points, since the document is known as the 46 Articles. After the rebels forced the council to accept the 46 Articles, they formed a committee of 10 to oversee the implementation of reforms. This committee, which included Hans von Siegen, drafted three supplemental articles, two of which treated rents and their extinguishment. Altogether, Articles 6, 11, 14, and 43 of the 46 Articles, and Articles 1 and 3 from the Committee of 10, dealt with rents and their use for endowment of intercessory institutions. Article 6 abolished undocumented rents. Article 11 made documented perpetual rents extinguishable. Article 14 placed all future endowed alms in the common chest and abolished intercessory institutions such as obits or annuals. Article 43 prescribed all ostentatious display at requiem masses. The additional articles from the Committee of Ten simply clarified the above points. One declared invalid all rents which were contrary to these concessions. Another held that no rents need be paid until their legality was documented. The Committee of Ten also asked the Council to consider transferring the revenues of confraternities, obits, and annuals to the common chest. It would be misleading to imply that perpetual rent charges and intercessory institutions were the only matters of concern for the Frankfurt dissidents, but the 46 Articles treated a variety of political, economic, and religious issues. However, it is fair to say that, judging from the negotiations over the implementation of the concessions, no issue was more sensitive or more hotly contested than the question of rent charges. The reforms posed problems of implementation, for the rents that they treated might be documented with legal or illegal seals, owed to local or foreign rent chargers, and paid to support secular or ecclesiastical interests. They therefore needed extensive clarification. During the months of May and June, ongoing deliberations between the council and the citizenry attempted to make the necessary interpretations. The steps taken toward implementation ultimately went for naught, because Frankfurt's noble neighbors forced the cancellation of all concessions to the citizenry after the defeat of the peasants' revolt. On July the 2nd, 1525, the council had to comply with the demands of Archbishop Richard of Trier, Elector Ludwig of the Palatinate, and Bishop Wilhelm of Strasbourg that the 46 Articles be declared null and void. Thus, the idealistic reforms of the Frankfurt rebels ended in abject defeat. The council felt that the 46 Articles went too far, but it still wanted to correct the destructive effects of the expansion of the ecclesiastical rent charges within the city. However, it did not succeed in making perpetual rents extinguishable until 1561, and then only after extensive diplomatic negotiations. From our discussion of rents, reform, and revolt, it is clear that the Frankfurt reformers, dissidents, and clergy perceived the interconnection of the doctrine of the Mass, the doctrine of purgatory, the endowed intercessory institutions, and the perpetual rent charges that provided for Mass priests. If the Mass were not a meritorious work, and if there were no purgatory, then there would be no need for the payment of rents that supported stipendiary clergy. The rebel leader Hans von Siegen and the evangelical brothers understood this all quite well, for they supported Dietrich Sartorius in his attack on the Mass and purgatory, they clashed with the Dominicans over the same issues, and they drafted articles of grievance demanding the abolition of perpetual rents and the conversion of revenues for intercessory institutions into monies for the common chest. The council and the citizenry further realized that there was a direct connection between the expansion of ecclesiastical perpetual rent charges on the one hand and the erosion of the city's tax base and the spread of urban blight on the other. The council tried to resolve the problem by working slowly and deliberately with the Archbishop of Mainz and the Emperor to find a way of making perpetual rents extinguishable, to find a way of stopping the spread of ecclesiastical rent charges. The rebels tried to accomplish a similar goal by using force instead of diplomacy and by attacking not the symptom, perpetual rents, but also the cause, endowed chantries and the theology of purgatory. In 1525, neither approach succeeded, though by 1561 the council's efforts finally paid off. The baneful effects of an inordinate number of ecclesiastical rents in Frankfurt attracted the attention not only of the council and the urban dissidents, but also of early evangelical reformers in the city. Hartmann Ebach and Dietrich Sartorius attacked the theology that supported intercessory institutions and opposed the rents that provided revenues for them. In this way, the early reform movement in Frankfurt differed from other regions, for it ignored themes more typical of the Reformation, like justification by faith or the universal priesthood of believers. Grievances against intercessory institutions and the rents that supported them do not, of themselves, explain the spread of reform and revolt in Frankfurt. But they were a central concern for Frankfurt's rulers, reformers, and rebels in 1525.
The thesis of this presentation is that powerful political relationships and their adjustments help determine when a smaller imperial city accepts the Reformation. It is not, obviously, a new thesis, despite an historiographical tendency to relate the Reformation only to theological and religious interest. At the onset, in order to be clear, the importance of religion is assumed. But importance alone cannot explain the acceptance and hence the spread of Protestantism. The two models or examples on which this thesis rests are the Franconian cities of Eisenburg and Schweinfurt, about each of whose Reformation history, as Reformation history, there is little contention. Both Weisenburg and Schweinfurt exhibit a large number of similarities. Each was small and located very close to its ordinary, Eichstätt and Würzburg, respectively. The ordinaries and their chapters exercised considerable control in the cities, possessing patronage rights in churches and benefices. Each city likewise encountered the might of secular neighboring lords, such as the Pappenheim, the Franconian Hohenzollern, and Henneberg. And these families often employed their power through legal machinery in territorial courts to further political goals which may be religious ones as well. In addition, nearby foundations like Wulzburg in Weisenburg and Haug in Schweinfurt influenced city policies by the exercise of traditional privileges. Finally, each depended on the advice and leadership of Nuremberg to an extraordinary degree. This was most obvious in the case of Weisenburg because better documentation exists, but it was just as important to Schweinfurt as this paper hopefully verifies. For both of these cities, the figure of Nuremberg's legal advisor, Christoph Schroerl, was of fundamental significance, perhaps more so for Schweinfurt, with whom he had little contact, than for Weizenburg, with whom he had much.
Weizenburg.
There is little debate on the course of the Reformation in Weizenburg, a small city of some 2,500 souls, located on the major trade route from Nuremberg to Augsburg. Difficulties between the local priest and the city in the second decade of the 16th century involve Weizenburg in disputes with the Bishop of Eichstätt. These accelerated anti-episcopal feelings within the city, ones that became more pronounced after the recess of Nuremberg in 1524. Largely dependent on Nuremberg for advice and support, and following Nuremberg's lead, about 800 Weizenburg citizens refused to attend the Easter service in 1525. With the arrival of an evangelically inclined minister, and strengthened by the Speyer Recess of 1526, the city acknowledged Lutheranism, a church order almost completely modeled on the 23 Schwabach Articles, confirmed the Reformation, and Weizenburg placed it into effect in January of 1529. This was later reaffirmed by the introduction of the Brandenburg-Nuremberg Church Order in 1533. Only then in the city was the Catholic Mass abolished. Thus, until the middle of the 1530s, that is, the time when the Reformation became fully institutionalized in the city, the bishop regarded Weizenburg as within his jurisdiction. Since powerful princes surrounded the small city, and despite its imperial status, Weizenburg undertook few unilateral actions. Rather, it depended on the support of Nuremberg, and this dependence became increasingly apparent during the 1520s and 1530s. Nuremberg represented Weizenburg's interest in the Reformation, and even allowed its lawyer and advisor, Dr. Christoph Schorl, to become special consultant to its daughter city. He occupied this position for some two decades as a series of almost 100 unpublished letters in the private Schorl family archive testifies. Throughout these years, in spite of the fact that Schorl remained religiously Catholic, Weizenburg utilized Schorl's services in nearly every small and large affair. Among the larger matters were Weizenburg's strained relationships with its secular neighbors, who used almost any occasion to attack the city's independence. Weizenburg's involvement with the House of Pappenheim illustrates the point. The Pappenheims, whose ancestral home was the small village of the same name near Weizenburg, had received the title of Imperial Marshal of the Empire in the 12th century, and it became hereditary in the family. The family likewise received preferential treatment from succeeding emperors, such as judicial authority in and around Weizenburg, Greisbach, and Donauwörth. The rights and privileges retained by the marshals often were exceedingly complex, akin to those occurring between the Margraves of Ansbach and Nuremberg, when the Margrave of Ansbach sold his rights to the city of Nuremberg in 1427. He retained a number of very important legal rights that led to contentions and continuous contentions between the city and the Margraviate until 1806. One vexatious problem was control of Zuffersheim, a very small, albeit significant village at that time, located between Weizenburg and Pappenheim. In the 13th century, Pappenheim acquired lordship of Zuffersheim and exercised it with the agreement of Eichstätt. Weizenburg took control of the village in the middle of the 15th century, although the Pappenheims retained some rights, especially with regard to ecclesiastical tenets. By the end of the century, the 15th century, the bishop became Zuffersheim's feudal overlord, although Weizenburg now retained some financial rights on subjects in the village. This situation became even more complicated when a Pappenheim, Christoph, became Bishop of Eichstätt in 1535. Resulting jurisdictional disputes led to Schorl's involvement as a representative of Weizenburg's interest in 1526, and they accounted for the last official trip of his life in 1536. By the latter date, The bishop, both as ordinary and as a Pappenheim, would seem to hold an inordinate amount of power vis-a-vis Weizenborn. But Schroyl's mediation attempts appeared successful by the 1540s. I say appeared successful because while Schroyl did not travel personally, he was continuously the major advisor on this jurisdictional dispute. They appeared successful by the 1540s. Zuffersheim remained in Weizenburg's control until the end of the empire. A second problem, also resolved in the 1530s, was the position of Reichspfleger. This office entailed judicial authority, and to its holder accrued financial rewards. In the struggle to occupy this post, Weizenburg became involved with the city of Donauwörth and the highest aspects of imperial patronage. At the onset of the 16th century, administration of imperial lands, Reichspflege, around Weizenburg, had been consolidated with those around Donauwörth. In 1502, Maximilian appointed his treasurer, Balthasar Wolff, son of a wealthy immigrant to Nuremberg, to this office for life. Because this post entailed subordinate appointments of a judicial and financial nature, it potentially wielded extensive influence on the cities of Weizenburg and Donauwörth. These cities, as well as Nuremberg and Augsburg, had vested interest in the succession when the Pfleger died early in 1529, and Schroyl soon became the middleman. In March of 1529, Nuremberg wrote its representative at the Diet of Speyer that both Nuremberg and Augsburg hoped to bring the office to one of their own, and the legation was to investigate this possibility. Shortly thereafter, Weizenburg independently sought Schroyl's advice in the same matter. Weizenburg's signature on the protest at Speyer perhaps accounted for the emperor's decision in 1530 to pawn the office to Donauwörth, who in turn installed a man favorable both to it and to Nuremberg and Augsburg, but implicitly attacking Weizenburg. Nevertheless, Weizenburg persisted in its efforts to acquire the Pflege, and it utilized Schroyl's aid in splitting these lands into its two original parts. Persistence paid off. And in 1534, that is the same time that the mass is abolished in Weizenburg, the city acquired its right to administer independently the land around the city. Now, as important as Zuffersheim and the Reichspflege were to Weizenburg's independence, both actually and symbolically, probably the most significant power to be neutralized, neighboring power to be neutralized, was the Margrave of Ansbach. The city feared this prince, who, in the person of Casimir, evinced his dislike of all imperial cities, only a bit less than his hatred for ecclesiastical principalities. Weizenburg's fear had a good basis, as Casimir's actions at Wurzburg testified. The Benedictine monastery of Wurzburg, located on a height immediately outside Weizenburg and in a commanding position over the city, possessed patronage rights in the city's parish church of St. Andreas. It therefore controlled a large portion of Weizenburg's official religious expression. Casimir, deeply in debt and completely misunderstanding the religious situation in the empire, acted only to stabilize and increase his own power. As early as 1516, when he in fact takes over the rule of the Margrave, he had cast his eyes on Wolfsburg. And a few years later, he and George, his brother and successor, had decided to secularize all of the cloisters in the Margrave. He took Wolfsburg in 1523, he transformed it into a secular foundation, and he replaced the abbot with his own brother, Gumbert. These actions received papal confirmation in 1526, and thus Casimir was in a position to intervene directly and indirectly in Weizenburg. This situation accounted for the city's desire that Nuremberg represent its interest in Franconian circle affairs in the mid-1520s. When Margrave George succeeded Casimir in 1527, he completed the Protestant Reformation in his territories. His and Nuremberg's able advisors, at odds with each other on so many issues and would continue to remain at odds with each other on so many issues, united on the Church Order of 1528 and the Brandenburg-Nuremberg Church Order of 1533. It is in this year, again, that Weisenburg abolished the Mass, thereby concluding the city's Reformation. Weisenburg could now appeal on the basis of religion to the Margrave to counter attempts at episcopal control. And these attempts at episcopal control by Eichstätt were very powerful. In Rublach's latest work, on the Reformation and the Episcopal Centers, Eichstätt is the only Episcopal Center of all that Rublach deals with that does not even entertain any idea of Protestant Reformation. At the same time, its acquisition, Weisenburg's acquisition of the Reichspflege, enhanced its independence while refuting both Eichstätt and Pappenheim claims to Zuffersheim. Schweinfurt. Like Weisenburg, Schweinfurt's Reformation history admits of little dispute. Pro-evangelical forces existed in the city almost from the onset. The mayor in the early 1520s held to the new teaching. Imperial knights under Sickingen met there to review the progress of Luther's views. The city instituted a common chest modeled on Luther's thought. A native verbally attacked a city chaplain and then defended his charges. A baptism took place in German. These and other events throughout the 1520s and the 1530s indicated the people's desire for Reformation. Yet despite repeated requests for the formal introduction of the Reformation, the council hesitated. Not until 1542, when Philip of Hesse acquired the protectorate of Schweinfurt from Wilhelm von Henneberg, did the city officially accept the Reformation. The major event, then, was a political transformation, the study of which exhibits the city's legal relationships with its neighbors. Schweinfurt was a small city, somewhat larger in size and riches than Weisenburg, and approximately equal in population. It became an imperial city in the 13th century, although one whose independence vacillated according to the degree of acrimony existing between two nearby lords, the powerful Bishop of Würzburg and the Count of Henneberg-Schlesingen, imperial protector of the city. Schweinfurt's relations with his Amtmann, or Vogt, Wilhelm IV of Henneberg, had always been somewhat less than cordial. In 1513, a rebellion directed against the government occurred in the city. Forcefully suppressed and with many leaders executed, Wilhelm further punished the city by decreeing that the community lost its right to elect its own Amtmann. Since the emperor agreed to this decree, Wilhelm was in effect making himself Schweinfurt's protector for life. Even though Maximilian restored the privilege to the city some months later, Schweinfurt remained intimidated and unwilling to test the right. A second major event that focused the city's fears on Wilhelm was his bearing during the Peasants' War. The Count had emerged as the leader of a newly created League of Franconian Knights, developed in Schweinfurt in 1523. These knights sought to protect themselves from attacks by the princes, especially the powerful Prince Bishop of Würzburg. In Wilhelm's view, however, he utilized the League to advance the independence of his territory of Henneberg rather than the goals of the knights. It was with some joy that he observed peasant attacks against Würzburg early in 1525, because he felt, and typically incorrectly, that he could use the peasants for his own ends. In this, Wilhelm's ideas were remarkably similar to those of Margrave Casimir's. After the peasants terrorized the city,
chapter and bishop of Würzburg, Wilhelm would then step in to appease these rebelling people by demanding the secularization of the episcopacy, for he thought they were protesting an ecclesiastical lord and desired a secular one. Only when the peasants refused to play the game according to Wilhelm's rules did he realize the danger he was in. They captured city upon city in the Main region. Schweinfurt capitulated, and the peasants burned the town of Henneberg and destroyed the count's castle at Meinberg. With these occurrences, Wilhelm then sided with the forces that put the rebellion at an end. He executed many of the leaders, and in Schweinfurt, he ordered the deaths of some of the town fathers for siding with the peasants. He also levied a large indemnity for the destruction of his castle at Meinberg. Similarly, he threatened the city with further reprisals if it got out of line again. If fear of Wilhelm characterized the city's internal policies, such fear was only inflamed by threats and actions that came from Würzburg, especially with regard to religion. These threats and actions came from two directions. The first was an outright threat by the bishop not to seek any alliance with pro-evangelical or anti-episcopal forces in Franconia. The second was, perhaps, more pervasive and persistent. It came from the Haug Foundation at Würzburg, which held patronage rights to Schweinfurt's parish church of St. Johannes. The same foundation was Zainteer for the city and paid the city's teachers from the parish tithes. Haug steadfastly refused to accept the city's desire for even a moderate evangelical preacher or teacher. These threats and actions inhibited any formal movement towards Protestantism in the late 1520s and throughout the 1530s. The major drama that made it possible for Schweinfurt to introduce the Reformation occurred in the late 1530s, and Henneberg again played the part of the antagonist. Both the city and the count experienced economic hardship in this decade, the city especially in the form of grain shortages. Upon recovery, upon economic recovery, Wilhelm demanded the abolition of Schweinfurt's sheep fields at Ottenhausen, and he disputed the city's claims to cow pastures, rabbit warrens, and some traditional jurisdictions. And Schweinfurt, as a result, lodged its complaint with the Imperial Supreme Court, a complaint backed up by Nuremberg a few years later. The city also sought for and received from King Ferdinand an imperial confirmation of its right to elect its own protector. Then it appealed to Nuremberg for help on how to replace Wilhelm. Nuremberg placed the affair in the hands of Christoph Schorl, who responded on May 30th, 1537. In Schorl's advice, he reviewed Schweinfurt's privileges from the time of Charles IV to the present. Then he wrote that when Wilhelm accepted the post of Amtmann, he had obliged himself to protect the city, not to harm it. Furthermore, Wilhelm promised on the basis of his princely dignity and in faith to step down freely, without opposition, if Schweinfurt desired another protector. Since the city had experienced damage from Wilhelm and due to the recent confirmation by Ferdinand of its right to elect its own Amtmann, Schweinfurt would be acting constitutionally in voting in another. Schorl thus advised the removal of Wilhelm solely on constitutional grounds. While some princes appeared interested in the office, Charles V, late in 1540, prohibited the city from acting any further or undertaking anything without his knowledge in this affair. Once again, Schorl emerged, this time in conjunction with a most unlikely prince, at least for him, Philip of Hesse. Philip stayed in Nuremberg in March 1541, on his way to the Reichstag at Regensburg, and he stayed in Schorl's house. More remarkable was the fact that Nuremberg's government arranged for this meeting and paid Schorl for Philip's expenses.
thereby bringing together its lawyer, who knew Schweinfurt's problems intimately, albeit he was a Catholic, and the man who would shortly become Schweinfurt's protector. And in 1542, with Philip of Hesse as Amtmann, Schweinfurt accepted the Reformation. This is the sticky part. It's impossible to know what the two discussed, as no record was kept. Undoubtedly, Philip's bigamy was a topic because Schwerl had written extensively on the subject. So, of course, had others in Nuremberg, lawyers who were more partial to Philip's. Any lawyer in Nuremberg was more partial to Philip's religious views than Schwerl was. Yet the anomaly is great. Philip meeting Schwerl at the expense of the Protestant city of Nuremberg, especially in the light of the fact that immediately following Philip's departure, Nuremberg's government turns around and places Schwerl's friend, Elector Albrecht of Mainz, in Schwerl's house. Given the data, it's difficult not to assume that Schwerl was to discuss Schweinfurt's situation with Philip and attempt to persuade him on constitutional bases to protect the city. This Philip did. Now, the smaller imperial cities experienced great difficulties on all fronts during the Reformation. Religion was important, and so was the preservation of their identities and their independence. Large cities such as Strasbourg and Nuremberg had the power, presumably, to enforce their own decisions and to counter actions of nearby princes. Smaller cities could not act quite so independently. In the case of the Reformation in Weisenburg, the city received the support, explicit and implicitly, both of the Margraves of Ansbach and Nuremberg. Schweinfurt, on the other hand, had to wait until a pro-evangelical prince entered the scene. In both cases, very definite interest, secular interest, aided the introduction of the Reformation.
Thank you, Mary and Phil. After the harvest has been done, it is Mosaic law that certain pieces are left in the harvest for the poor people of the village to come around and collect them. So I shall now begin my collection run through the harvested field, trying to find something to say. That was a joke by way of introduction. We have heard two excellent papers on the social, economic, and legal political aspects of the Reformation, as illustrated by events in the imperial cities of Frankfurt, Weissenberg, and Schweinfurt. Except for the different aspects that are being treated in both papers, the major difference between both papers is the fact that Buck's papers on rents, reform, and revolt in the 16th century Frankfurt deals with the emergence of the Reformation, while Beb's paper on paving the way for the Reformation in Weissenburg and Schweinfurt deals with the establishment, the organization of the Reformation by secular authorities. Both authors argue that elements other than religious ones significantly contributed to the emergence of the Reformation in Frankfurt, so Buck, or to the establishment of the Reformation in Weissenburg and Schweinfurt, so Beb. Both authors admit that their thesis is nothing new, yet the material which both authors produce makes their paper not only significant contributions to local history, but also, and this fact has to be underscored, to the argument which many of us have been pushed now for quite some time, namely that the Reformation was a multifaceted movement in which the religious elements were embedded in other equally significant elements, and which therefore may not be one-sidedly explained from the viewpoint of the religious elements, but which has to be explained in such a way that justice is being done to all the elements that played a role at the time. Buck argues that no issue was more hotly contested in Frankfurt than that of rent charges. Inasmuch as mass, purgatory, intercessions, and other ideas and practices of the papal church provided the theological foundation for the rent charges, it was only natural that when evangelical preachers, Ebach, Sartorius, and Westerberg, attacked these ideas and practices with theological arguments, that then the rent charges as such also would be attacked, and a movement would develop that would demand their abolition.
given the particular local circumstances, namely a city in which the council for quite some time tried unsuccessfully to get a handle on these economic issues, it is clear then that the situation in Frankfurt provides an ideal model for the interconnection of social, economic, and religious issues, or, to say it differently, for the way in which the evangelical elements were used or abused to justify demands for economic reform. The issue of the rent charges was around for quite some time prior to the appearance of the evangelical preachers. Therefore, one may argue that the preachers provided a religious moral justification for that which certain people wanted to do anyhow. These people are to be divided into two groups: the establishment, represented by the council that was chafing on the bit of the rent charges, and the evangelical brothers, led by Hans von Siegen. Since the council did not pick up the theological arguments and pursued a concerted anti-rent charges policy at this point, but the evangelical brothers did pick up the theological arguments, they were pushed into playing the role of the anti-establishment, and in spring of 1525, the council was forced to play the role of the sorcerer's apprentice. This much for the paper. Now some comments and questions. Bach's presentation makes obvious that Franz Lau's term, Der Wildwuchs der Reformation, may not be abandoned as Siegfried Breuer recently demanded. The terms reform and reformation as a movement concerned with spiritual religious elements cover the multitudes of sins, and it is our task to crystallize the various elements of the Reformation out of the melange of ideas and movements which we find in the 1520s. It seems to me that the profile of the evangelical preachers and the role they played in Frankfurt is not clear in Bach's paper, except for the role of Westerburg, of whom we have quite some information. The bridge between Ebach's and Sartorius' sermons to the evangelical brothers is a little bit shaky, at least for this theologian. Admit it, in Frankfurt, the Mass and Purgatory stood in the center of the discussion so that the theological foundation of the rent charges was attacked. Now, whether this was unique for Frankfurt would be a matter open for debate, and one would have to look at other cities. Admit it further, Ebach did attack rent charges and apparently did make some impression on the opposition in the council. But did he only add fuel to an already burning fire? Was he simply the social religious agitator who picked a hot topic hoping to get public support? Did he provide a sound theological rationale? And if so, how did this theology measure up to that of, let us say, Luther? Sartorius, on the other hand, apparently did not preach against the rent charges. In what way, then, did he influence the people? Bach speaks of a considerable influence at this point. I am quite willing to buy Bach's thesis to the effect that the stand taken by Ebach and Sartorius against certain ideas and practices of the papal church influenced the evangelical brothers. But in the 1520s, many people called themselves evangelical. My question, therefore, would be, what did this mean in the case of the Frankfurt evangelical brothers? And finally, was there popular discontent with the rent charges in Frankfurt prior to the arrival of Ebach and Sartorius? Was there a fire burning in Frankfurt to which Ebach and Sartorius only added fuel? Or were rent charges an issue only for the city council, but not for the populace? If the latter was the case, then the preachers would have lit the fire, and we would perhaps have one key, certainly not the only one, for the fact that the council did not jump on the bandwagon of Ebach and Sartorius by picking up their arguments and push now once again for the settlement of the rent charges issue, but now fortified with theological arguments. In sum, it seems to me that Bach has an excellent opportunity to make a significant contribution to the multifacetedness of the Reformation by developing a more chiseled profile of the evangelical preachers and of their religious elements, as well as of the religious elements of the evangelical brothers, and then contrast this profile
with the evangelical positions outlined by some of the mainline reformers. It would be interesting to pursue the question whether the role played by Sartorius was similar to that of Münzer or to that of Luther in the Peasants' War at large. This much for Bock's paper. Now to Bebb's paper. Bebb argues that powerful political relationships and their adjustments determine when a smaller imperial city accepts the Reformation. Further, smaller cities could not act quite so independently as the larger cities were able to do, and consequently they were dependent upon the support they could and actually did receive from some larger cities or some friendly neighboring ruler. Bebb illustrates his argument by developing a picture of the events in Weissenburg and Schweinfurt. In case of Weissenburg, the issue was the interference in the affairs of the city by the neighboring counts of Pappenheim, the Bishop of Eichstätt, and Casimir, the Margrave of Brandenburg-Ansbach-Kulmbach. At issue was further the administration of some imperial land in which Weissenburg and other cities were interested. With the help of Scheuel and the support of the city of Nuremberg, Weissenburg was able to settle these matters to his satisfaction, and in 1533 the city abolished the mass, thus concluding the Reformation. In case of Schweinfurt, it was the imperial Amtmann or protector, the Count of Henneberg, and also the Bishop of Würzburg in general and the members of the specific ecclesiastical foundation in Würzburg in particular, who interfered with the integrity of the city. Henneberg tried to push the city around according to his whims, and it was not until the early 1540s that Schweinfurt, supported by the legal expertise of Scheuel, was able to exchange Henneberg for Philip of Hesse as protector of the city. Soon thereafter, in 1542, the city accepted the Reformation. Bebb's paper is a highly condensed piece of writing. He tells me that certain materials haven't arrived from Germany, so that he had to make do with whatever he had available. Consequently, some of my remarks may be not appropriate. In any case, one can look at Bebb's paper from two viewpoints, a fact which makes this paper quite fascinating reading. One can see in the paper a contribution to a Scheuel biography, and as we all know, Bebb is working on such biographies. If one approaches the paper from this point of view, then one would have to ask at once, how in the world did Scheuel, who throughout his life remained a faithful member of the Roman Catholic Church, get involved with cities in which the Reformation as a religious movement was active? Scheuel was not so naive or uninformed as not to know what in terms of religion was going on in Weissenburg and in Schweinfurt. If this was so, then we need some detail about the role which the religious situation of the day played in the relationships between Scheuel and these two cities. Here seems to me is a lacuna. One can look at Bebb's paper also from the viewpoint of local history, and if one does this, then certain other problems would arise. Granted, on September 20th, 1524, the Nuremberg City Council advised Weissenburg on the question what to do with the evangelical movement in the city. Granted that from that day close contact existed between Weissenburg and Nuremberg regarding the religious situation. Granted, Scheuel was instrumental in setting the city's affair with the Pappenheim and regarding the administration of the imperial land. But these settlements were not accomplished until 1533 or even 1540. Yet, as early as 1528-29, Weissenburg officially accepted the Reformation by introducing a church ordinance. Bebb points this out, but it seems to me that somehow this gets lost in the rest of his argument. The fact that the council did not prohibit the celebration of the masses until 1533 does in no way jeopardize the weight of the statement. Weissenburg was a Protestant city, so in the spring of 1529, and it was a Lutheran city as of July 16, 1530. And in November of 1530, 447 citizens rejected the upsheet of the 1530 Diet of Augsburg and thus adopted the position of disobedience against the emperor, while only seven citizens of the city affirmed the option. And all this happened while the issues mentioned by Bebb were not yet settled. In fact, were not even close to being settled. Perhaps one could suggest then that Weissenburg joined the evangelical camp and gained the support of Nuremberg for the settling of its affairs
so that the Reformation paved the way for the strengthening of the integrity of the city. This suggestion presents a slightly different picture than Bebb has presented. For him, it was exactly the other way around. The strengthening of the integrity of the city paved the way for the Reformation. This much on Weissenburg. Now to Schweinfurt. Until such time that we know more about the role that religion played, A, in the policies of the Henneberg, and B, especially B, in the switch of Schweinfurt from Henneberg to Hesse as protector, I hesitate to affirm the picture that Bebb develops of the situation in Schweinfurt. In the 1530s, the Count of Henneberg was still a papist, at least on paper. Did his religion influence him sufficiently enough to support Würzburg against the evangelical movement in Schweinfurt? Or did the fact that Henneberg did not support Schweinfurt against Würzburg and thus did not act as protector in the best interest of the cities, does that fact suggest that Henneberg wanted to fish in murky waters guided by the motto, when two quarrel, that is, Würzburg and Schweinfurt, a third, that is, Henneberg, will profit? If the Schweinfurt Council could have accommodated itself to the whims of Henneberg, would then Henneberg have opposed the establishment of the Reformation in Schweinfurt? I am bold, foolish enough to suggest a negative answer. Why? Because the Henneberg themselves organized the Reformation in their territories just about the time that they lost the protectorate over Schweinfurt. In fact, as early as 1539, Henneberg installed in another protectorate that they were running, the imperial village of Senfeld outside Schweinfurt, an evangelical preacher. In 1540, when Henneberg was still the protector of Schweinfurt, the city made a first effort, legal effort, to organize the Reformation within its walls by approaching Wittenberg and requesting an evangelical preacher that would come to the city to organize the Reformation. Yet Wittenberg at that point was unable to supply such a man. It seems to me then that the delay in Schweinfurt's public acknowledgement of the Reformation by officially establishing the religious movement within its walls had little to do with the city's friction with Henneberg, unless one wishes to blame the Henneberg for not supporting the city against Würzburg. The delay in this public acceptance of the Reformation seems to me has a lot to do with the city's relationship with Würzburg, and even more with the makeup and the structure of the evangelical movement in the city, especially the lack of pastoral leadership. Now, with these remarks, I am not suggesting that the change in the protectorship from Henneberg to Hesse did not pave the way for the Reformation in Schweinfurt. After all, it was Philip who finally provided the city with a badly needed evangelical preacher. But I am suggesting that as Bebb's paper stands right now, in terms of the religious situation, the role of Henneberg is unclear. The fact that prior to 1542, that is, prior to the switch in the protectorship from Henneberg to Hesse, Schweinfurt did not establish the Reformation need not necessarily have been caused by the city's friction with Henneberg. Now, I am sure that Phil can refute the validity of this suggestion, which obviously has been made by a fool who rushed in where angels fear to tread. I'm very proud that I got that English proverb straight in that practice.
Very hard.
Thank you very much.
I apologize for standing, but sitting down and getting up all the time is very, very tough for me. So, you're open for a question. I suppose probably both Larry and Phil would like to respond. We were not able to exchange things before this morning, so things are a little bit up in the air right now. Perhaps before we do this, is there a desire to, we have about some 15 minutes, maybe we should stretch for 1 minute in order to get the old bones a little bit shaken up and then start. So let me just get up, down, up, down, up, down, and then go.
I have a
One brief response for a long response. Well, we don't want to listen. That's how you'll get caught. I think you can't find it together. Do you want to talk? Yes, please. Back some, yeah, a little bit of heat.